Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests today. First, in moments, we'll hear from Lily Geismer about the evolution of suburban liberalism and its influence in the Democratic Party. And then at the bottom of the hour, the remarkable polymath and expert on all things French, Art Goldhammer, will give us some background on the Charlie Hebdo affair. First, Lily Geismer. Geismer, who teaches history at Claremont McKenna College, is the author of Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberals and the Transformation of the Democratic Party, just out from Princeton University Press. Most analyses of the rightward move of U.S. politics focus on the rise of the so-called Reagan Democrats, the race-lubricated conservative turn of the old New Deal coalition. Left out of this analysis is the rise of a demographic that Geismer focuses on in this excellent book, a mostly suburban, socially liberal, but economically orthodox professional managerial class that's all for diversity as long as it doesn't hit their pocketbooks. They use the deeply individualistic language of choice and opportunity rather than the universal, solidaristic language of social democracy, and they become central to today's Democratic Party. Geismer's book focuses on five suburban towns along Route 128 around Boston, but her analysis also applies to many other suburban readouts around the country, and increasingly to gentrified urban neighborhoods in Brooklyn and San Francisco. Lily Geismer. So, Route 128, first of all, tell us a bit of the history of the highway and what developed along it and when.
Route 128, people in Boston often ask me this or who don't know the area. It's actually the combination of 95 and 93. And it was originally constructed in the 50s as a largely sort of commuter highway. The idea was a commuter highway and actually to connect for tourists to be able to get to New Hampshire and Maine and then down to Cape Cod. And a developer realized that there was all this new tech growth emerging around Harvard and MIT and Cambridge, and there wasn't space for those companies to develop. So there was all these spin-offs that kind of came from labs at Harvard and MIT, and so they figured out that they could create industrial parks along the roadway, and that's kind of what really spurred Route 128 industry. And then along Route 128 were also this set of suburban communities. Many of them were actually sort of old New England towns that became very exclusive suburbs through these processes of suburbanization. So like Lexington and Concord and Newton that had been longstanding communities but really go through this sort of suburbanization and became very attractive to people who were living and who were working along the highway and at Harvard and MIT.
And these towns, with their history of being like country towns initially, wanted to preserve that as they got suburbanized, right, and not become Levittown. That was a very core part of their identity.
Yes. So one of the towns, Newton, their promotional tagline was "No Ordinary Suburb." And so part of their idea was that they were not like the kind of mass-produced suburbs. And they often sort of talked about how the town of Lincoln, for instance, sort of talked about how it was a suburb by accident of geography, but it was a very deliberate processes that sort of maintained their looking like sort of charming towns. They had really, really restrictive zoning policies, which they implemented in the 1950s and 60s. So they had 1 acre minimum lot zoning, and often 2 acre minimum lots in places like Lincoln, and also no multi-unit housing. So this also restricted who could live in the community so that they were very beautiful, but they also were largely exclusive.
They were shaped by zoning, meaning state practice, but also redlining to some degree, right?
Yes. I mean, they have long-standing patterns of redlining, and then also just the larger sort of traditions of where Federal Housing Administration policies of mortgages would allow who could move into these communities. So it builds on this much longer-standing state and federal policy. And I should say another thing about these communities that's quite important is that they all had reputations as really good school districts, which also comes from is a legacy or emerges from these kinds of zoning policies because it restricted the population that was coming in.
The schools were locally financed very heavily, right? So they were very conscious about keeping costs down while the education stayed high.
Yes.
Limiting the population and the kinds of people who settled there were very much a tax limitation strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, they had and some of these communities did, like the suburb of Newton did have a high tax rate, but the idea that was sort of a premium people paid for quality education. And the tax rate was significantly less than the city of Boston.
And they were also very conscious about preserving open space, which sounds very high-minded and lovely and nice to look at, but also is a way of limiting the population and the kinds of people who could settle there.
Yes, absolutely. And so some of these communities have really extraordinarily aggressive open space programs that emerge, and actually sort of from grassroots politics, but use state power in which to restrict building. And so by the 1970s, one-fourth of the town of Concord is under protected land. So that really limits the kind of, makes the community a lot more exclusive, but sort of particularly limits any kind of affordable housing from being constructed. So, and that's one thing that my book looks at in depth, is these kind of fierce battles that emerge over the sort of development of affordable housing in places like Concord, where there's very little land on which they could be built.
And the names Lexington and Concord are just resonate with the American Revolutionary tradition. So they're very proud of that and conscious of it, right?
Yeah, and that's it's a huge part of the kind of local identity of these particular communities. And so, and especially is another reason that a lot of sort of liberal-minded people wanted to move to them. So that the idea of sort of Lexington stands in for kind of these revolutionary tradition and notions of tolerance and things like that. And it's really sort of inscribed into the communities at the local level. And then one thing I look at is that those are sort of are inscribed into the identity of Massachusetts writ large. And so this idea of Massachusetts being the kind of cradle of liberty, so you see it as these communities become a microcosm of that.
And along those lines, the cradle of liberty is also not far from the John Birch Society headquarters, right, in Belmont?
No, actually, I mean, that's one of the things that but I've tried to sort of challenge in my book. There's been a large assumption that of kind of reading the red state, blue state map onto suburban areas, and there's been a lot of work done on the rise of conservatism in places like Orange County, and particularly the John Birch Society. But actually, the founder of the John Birch Society was from the town of Belmont, which is one of those kind of Route 128 highways. So that it shows that they're kind of liberal and conservative people in all suburbs.
But the towns that you write about, the five towns, not like the five towns on Long Island, but the five towns along Route 128. Are demographically and politically distinct from what people think of as your normal suburb, aren't they? What's the population of these towns like?
So the population, and it changes as new population comes in. So these people, these kind of knowledge workers who are workers in post-industrial service-oriented jobs, particularly sort of engineers, lawyers, other kinds of academics, who do lean more Democratic. And so the towns, these were traditionally very Republican towns before World War II, but they become increasingly liberal with this new, or Democratic with this new population. There's still always a sort of, it's not like the whole town moves in that direction. I mean, there's still a strong conservative population or sort of Republican population in these communities. And actually at the state level, they consistently do vote Republican, but in national elections become very Democratic.
But there was also the Massachusetts Republican, which is now a nearly extinct species, but the liberal Republican of the Massachusetts kind. Were there bases in these communities too?
Absolutely, and really, really strong. And so, I mean, consistently there's a really high level of split ticket voting. And so the Republican, the sort of liberal Republicans, and so the book looks extensively at a figure named Frank Sargent, who was governor in the late 1960s, but was the person who led the charge against the sort of highway moratorium, was against the Vietnam War, very environmentalist. So he sort of stands in as a liberal Republican. But Massachusetts has a long-standing tradition, and this is true in these communities as well, of voting for maybe not liberal Republicans, but moderate Republicans. And that's sort of how Mitt Romney becomes governor, and the new governor, Charlie Baker, falls very much in line with this tradition of kind of being socially moderate, at least that's what Mitt Romney was when he ran for governor of Massachusetts, and fiscally conservative. The book looks at kind of that politics is an anomalous, but it falls in line with the kind of values of these communities who are often liberal on issues that are further and further away from their property values, tax rates, and children's education. And my larger argument is that's not just true in that's not distinct to Massachusetts, but you can see that happening in a lot of sort of these suburban-centered states, particularly in the Northeast and then places like California.
Yeah, it's funny now that Mitt Romney is talking about running to the right of Jeb Bush, but he used to be a Massachusetts moderate, yes. Okay, now let's talk some about those politics. There are certain issues that really galvanize these populations. First, there are the housewives, right, who were the organizing core, and then as the women went to work, that changed. But in the 60s, there was a fair housing movement, which I believe got started around the attempt of a Foreign Service officer to buy, a black Foreign Service officer to buy a house in Lexington.
Well, that was, so the movement happened, the movement preceded that particular instance, but in the late 19, there was a huge amount, I mean, so this goes back to your question about redlining. The suburbs of Boston, I mean, like the suburbs of most cities in the United States, were profoundly segregated. And the many of the sort of liberal people who moved to this to these communities got involved in the fair housing movement, which is a national movement, but was most active in the Boston suburbs. And so the idea was to sort of help African Americans who wanted to buy homes in the suburbs do so. And so one of the cases I look at is a case of a African American Foreign Service officer in Lexington who wanted to move into Lexington. He was discriminated against, and so they launched a campaign to help him move in. The community also worked, so they used those kinds of sort of protest tactics. They also worked within the legal system, and so got Massachusetts to pass very progressive fair housing laws. But many of these laws were about just non-discrimination and didn't actively do things to sort of address the kind of structural dimensions that made it why so few African Americans could move into places like Lexington and Concord. And so one of the things that these kind of movements did is it sort of was the idea that everyone has the right to live where they want, but that only ended up helping middle-class African Americans and a very small percentage of them move into the suburbs.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with the principle that people should be able to live where they want, but these are communities that were designed specifically to formalize economic segregation, which will inevitably in America have a racial dimension to it. But they were not really interested in querying the geography of privilege. They were just more about equality of opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. And so, a lot of the language that they use is this very broad language of sort of absolute equality of opportunity, meritocracy, that doesn't actually, and I argue actually obscures these larger sort of structural realities that, that have led to systemic racial and economic segregation.
Yeah, and you've got several maps in the book that show that in these communities, when they started the fair housing movement, they were perhaps, what, 0.5% black, and now they're 2 or 3%. So the transformation has been less than profound.
Yes, and so, I mean, it's a symbolically really important movement, and I think one of the things about the fair housing movement is it does challenge the notion that everyone who lives in the suburbs was sort of part of the John Birch Society and fiercely opposed to integration, but that form of integration was what I argue had a profound class blindness to it that actually sort of didn't understand these kinds of, or didn't allow for the either challenging of privilege, but also see sort of the structural dimensions of segregation.
This puts one in the mind of the Phil Oaks song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal.
Yeah. Lily, I was thinking of using that as an early title for the book.
I'm speaking with Lily Geisler, who is the author of Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberals and the Transformation of the Democratic Party, just out from Princeton University Press. And then they also were also very central to the anti-Vietnam War movement, right?
Yeah, and that was another really important question about sort of what kinds of politics did they get involved in. A lot of the residents of these communities were at the forefront of the anti-war movement. It actually comes from a resident of Newton, one of the suburbs I look at, had the idea for the Vietnam moratorium, which is the largest protest in American history, was the largest protest in American history. And so this is this national movement of kind of protesting against the Vietnam War, and it's seen as having this major turning point.
And it's interesting that initially when they were thinking of this, people were talking about a general strike or something like that, but that sounded too incendiary and too labor-oriented, right?
Yeah, they sort of saw that as that was exactly right, and that kind of had that had too much of a kind of materialist dimension to it. So the idea was that this would sort of be a way to get particularly middle class people out to protest the war. So it was a more sort of symbolic action, and that's a question of sort of another thing of sort of what are the limits of taking sort of symbolic action. One of the things I find really interesting about the anti-war movement emerging in these communities is they all had most of them and most of the residents had ties to the defense industry. I mean, that's how a lot of the money of their jobs and livelihoods, if they worked at, they worked in the research defense industry. But a lot of them were very opposed to the Vietnam War, which they saw as taking resources from kind of other types of scientific development. So you see a lot of kind of scientists out in opposition to the Vietnam War.
And the McGovern campaign in 72, when McGovern was talking about converting from military to civilian economy, that had a lot of traction in these suburbs.
Yeah, and that's another thing that has been the most surprising and exciting about the research for this book, which is that I started out wanting to write about the McGovern campaign because that sort of is this stands in for this idea of Massachusetts being the most liberal place, and because it was the only state McGovern won, and sort of thinking about why he did so well in these sort of suburban communities. And what I found is actually right before the 1972 campaign, there was a really sharp downturn in defense industry with the sort of, particularly the Nixon era cutbacks, and a lot of people felt their livelihoods were threatened. And so McGovern was a staunch advocate for military reconversion and campaigned on that, particularly trying to appeal to engineers and other kinds of scientists about sort of taking the resources of the defense industry and moving it into things like green energy, high tech, and things like that. And so one of my arguments is that many people look at McGovern as kind of the failure of the Democratic Party and what people like the New Democrats were sort of moving against, but actually he stands in for an early version of this kind of tech-oriented politician, which is really where the party sort of moves towards by the 1970s and 1980s. And he actually won a huge, not just in Massachusetts, but across the country, won a majority of knowledge workers, particularly in the suburbs.
And a couple of other obsessions of theirs, environmental politics, but of a certain sort, right? They're not concerned about, say, toxic waste dumps in the Mississippi Delta.
Not particular. There's not a lot of campaigns around that. No, it's much more the sort of these kinds of open space campaigns. And so one of the things that I've tried to argue is that's actually in a large part materialist, and sort of it's the idea of quality of life. These are things about improving their own quality of life, both for having sort of nicer spaces, but also for being able, as we talked about, to preserve their kind of property values in these communities. And so one of the things that happens is in a lot of these towns are opposed to the expansion of the highway system, but then also oppose the expansion of the mass transit into their suburbs because that might bring out kind of undesirable population. And so that speaks to the kind of particularities of the environmental politics in which they practice.
And also you have an interesting chapter on suburban feminism. What was that? What characterized that?
One of the things that was important was to sort of think about how and why the feminist movement took hold in suburban communities. And so one of the reasons I looked at feminism from a kind of, I guess, intellectual question was that there's this idea that liberalism sort of died in the 70s, and that you can see this kind of continuation of liberal politics through feminism. What I looked at is the ways in which a lot of the kind of feminist politics map onto these the suburban liberal notions of kind of individualism and freedom of choice. And so advocated for things, particularly Massachusetts, were very strong on getting the state equal rights amendment passed, but then the state passed very restrictive abortion laws in the vein of the Hyde Amendment, and suburban feminists worked less hard to advocate for low-income people to have access to abortion. So that's one of the ways you can think about the types of sort of individualist politics that emerge.
It sounds like the ancestor of Sheryl Sandberg, lean-in feminism.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of dimensions of that. I mean, it's another one of sort of the ways in which feminism can often have a focus on individual choice that actually can limit sort of thinking more collectively. This is persisted around the tensions in feminism today.
And chronologically, we skipped past the thing which made Boston nationally famous, the fight over busing. But some of these communities had voluntary programs to bring kids from Boston out to their fancy suburban schools, but in strictly limited numbers, right?
Yeah, and so Boston, one of the things that Boston is well known for is a program called the METCO program, which was a voluntary integration program started in 1966. And it was actually a group of these sort of suburban liberals I write about who emerged from the fair housing movement, who had the initial idea for METCO, which was to sort of to bring self-state sponsored, but to bring African-American students into the suburbs. It's the oldest and largest voluntary busing program in the country. And so it was very popular in the suburbs because, and one of the things I argue in the book is it actually prefigures some of the arguments around affirmative action. So one of the ways that the program got suburban communities to accept the African-American students was the idea that it's good for white children to be around African-American students. It'll help them kind of in a, help them succeed in a kind of diverse world. And for the African-American students, the advantage was that they were able to go to school in some of the best school districts in the country. But the program itself had, there are some sort of key problematic dimensions to that sort of configuration. And then the other issue that came up was that in the 1970s, at the same at the height of the Boston crisis, there was an effort to expand the program, but the state needed suburbs to kick in some of the money for it, and a lot of the communities refused to pay any of their own local tax dollars towards the program. So it's persisted, but it has remained the same size as it was in the 1970s. And so one of the things about METCO today is that it has a wait list of about 12,000 students from Boston who try to get, who are trying to get spaces into it. Most, I think it's a one-fourth of children who are eligible for the program are on that wait list. And most parents sign their kids up before their first birthday. But it's remained about, I think there's about 5,000 students enrolled in about 40 suburbs now.
A drop in the bucket, in other words.
Yes. It's been really successful in terms of a lot of the students from the METCO program have gone on to college, sort of one of the markers of its success. So it's been influential for many of the students who've been involved, but has not addressed the kind of large disparities in the educational system of the suburbs of Boston and the Boston public schools.
Okay, and so we move towards a conclusion. How representative of a class of people across the country are these suburbs, and how have they affected democratic politics?
Well, I think that they're profoundly influential in sort of representing a key shift that's occurred within the Democratic Party. And so as the base of the party has moved away from kind of union, its union base in cities, it really is the sort of suburban voters who become the base of the party. And I don't think that this is just unique to Massachusetts, but it's true of tech-oriented suburban communities across the country. So Silicon Valley, you can see it in Colorado, the Research Triangle, the suburbs of New York. I mean, these are really, this is really who the base of the party has become. And I think that one of the things that has happened is there's sort of, this is kind of who the party is seeking to appeal to in a lot of its, in a lot of its sort of agenda, which has certain key possibilities, but also has limits in that and you can understand kind of the party through looking to these people.
And this is not the kind of thing that's going to win white working class voters then?
No, this is a strategy that's sort of keyed into a very middle class electorate. And particularly, I mean, it's not, this type of voter tends to not be particularly interested in union politics and other kinds of redistributive solutions. And so traditionally those have been the kind of issues that have been important to kind of winning back white working class voters. And so I think that that's one of the questions here, that you can see this kind of persistence of a key tension within the Democratic coalition.
And is this demographic large enough to use it as your electoral base, or are they pretty, I mean, what share of the population qualifies?
It's always hard to measure. I think it's a small percentage of the population, but it's a profoundly influential one. And that's one of the questions it's a percentage of the population that votes in larger numbers than other groups. So I think that even though the Democratic Party cannot be viable if it just looks to the suburbs, but a lot of there's a question of sort of how much is this limiting its ability to kind of reach larger groups or address more, more issues of that are more equitable.
And these are, you know, professors and lawyers and engineers, people with a lot of skills and a lot of connections and know how to work the system.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's really amazing about the particular kinds of grassroots politics I look at, that they often lead to, they often have a national impact because of the kinds of ways of working within the system, so that that they can have they do have an impact in those key ways. Not on everything, and I think that that's one of the things that I tried to to emphasize is that I think there's a sense that to understand sort of what is and isn't in control in so an individual's control. I mean, so just voting for Obama is not gonna sort of have a radical impact. And I think that's been one of the sort of ideas, or getting even a piece of legislation passed. These are so many of the issues that I look at, or are sort of the key problems in it today, are much more complicated and structural.
And these, of course, are people who are very committed to working within the system.
Yes. So, I mean, that's the difference. I mean, that's always what I get asked a lot, you know, what's liberalism? And I think that the difference of liberal to radical is an idea, is a commitment to the system. You're trying to change the system. You're not trying to kind of explode it.
That was Lily Geismer, author of Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberals and the Transformation of the Democratic Party, just out from Princeton University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News.
I'm in love with water cruise lines, 128 where the dark outsides. I'm in love with Massachusetts. I'm in love with the radio on. It helps me from being alone late at night. Helps me from being lonely late at night. I don't feel so bad now.
How some of Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers hymn to Route 128, Roadrunner. Next, Art Goldhammer. Art is a fellow at the Center for European Studies at Harvard. He's most famous for his translation of Thomas Piketty's Capital of the 21st Century, but he's translated well over 100 other books from the French, and he knows a ton about French politics and culture. When the massacre at the Paris office of Charlie Hebdo happened last week, I thought Art would be a good guide to understanding what happened. First, Art, could you tell us what kind of culture, what kind of tradition Charlie Hebdo emerged from?
There's a long tradition of political satire in France, political and religious satire. You have to remember that France entered modernity as a divine right monarchy. So that the revolution was directed against a king who was supposed to be the vicar of God on earth. So blasphemy was an essential part of the French political tradition. And it continued through the 19th century after the French Revolution with cartoonists like Daumier, who attacked Louis-Philippe, the bourgeois monarch, by portraying him with a pear-shaped head, for example. So before the revolution, you can think of the obscene cartoons that were drawn of Marie Antoinette and other royals. So this volatile mixture of anti-religion, sexual lampooning, and mockery of people in power is the essence of the French cartoon, the French political cartoon satirical tradition.
And Charlie itself arose, what, in the wake of 68?
Yes, it was actually the successor publication to another magazine called Harakiri Hebdo. Hebdo is short for hebdomadaire, which means weekly. So Harakiri started a little before the 1968 events, and it was directed against Gaullism and the Gaullist control of the press. As you may know, during the Algerian War, there were things that you couldn't publish in the French press, references to torture in Algeria by French troops, for example. And then there was a kind of self-censorship exercised by the mainstream press. So the people who started Harakiri, some of whom went on to work for Charlie Hebdo in the early days, took this Gaullist censorship of the press as their main target. And then the general turmoil of 1968 led them to continue this tradition after Harakiri was shut down for I forget what offense, but they did something that brought them afoul of the law. So that magazine was shut down.
Did they made a joke about de Gaulle's death, didn't they, on the cover?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. That's right. They referred to a dance at Colombey. Colombey was de Gaulle's hometown, Colombey les Deux Églises. And in the same week, this is important because it shows that you have to understand the context of each cartoon really to understand what the cartoonists were trying to say. So they made a joke about a ball at a Colombey, a dance, in which one person was killed. That one person was Charles de Gaulle. One person died. But in the same week there, or a couple of weeks before, there had been a fire at a dance hall that had killed 40 young people. So in a somewhat tasteless way, the cartoonist was, for Harakiri at that point, was referring to this mass death and made this joke about de Gaulle's death, and that's what led to the closing down of the magazine, which then reemerged as Charlie.
And then Charlie had a run and then suspended publication for much of the 90s and then was revived. Right?
Yes, that's right. It actually gradually lost popularity. The brand of humor that it had pioneered in the 1960s, which was heavily influenced by the cartoonist's own admission by Mad Magazine in the United States, was a kind of mixture of adolescent humor with this old political tradition of French tradition of political satire. And I think it was the adolescence of the humor that gradually faded and lost popularity in the 1990s. And the circulation was dwindling. The financial situation of the magazine was getting more and more difficult. But it was eventually revived.
And its circulation had been dwindling in recent years, right? It was barely keeping nostrils above water.
It was down to about 50,000, and I believe they were periodically issuing calls for donations in order to keep themselves going, because the amount they were earning from subscriptions and newsstands sales wasn't enough to pay for the cost of producing the magazine. But a lot of publications are, of course, in that situation today. And Charlie's difficulty was compounded by the fact that it didn't have a web presence. I don't know why they didn't go to the web, but they didn't. And therefore, it was difficult for me here in the United States to keep up with what they were publishing. Not that I was a regular reader, even when I was in France.
Yeah, well, I've seen you characterize the content as rather juvenile, right? And perhaps rude and not the most politically constructive way.
Right. Well, they themselves described their style as bête et méchant, which means stupid and nasty. That itself was a satirical reference to their style. I don't think they thought of themselves as stupid and nasty, but
nasty maybe, but not stupid.
It was at times nasty, at times gentler than that. And you also have to remember that the cartoonists who wrote for this magazine, who drew for this magazine, also published elsewhere in more mainstream publications where their humor was a little more restrained. So Charlie was their outlet for their nastier side, their more irreverent side. When they did editorial cartoons for more mainstream publications, they were more self-constrained.
And now onto more recent history. A friend of mine wrote on Facebook this morning that the first thing you need to know about Charlie is that it was misanthropic, to which a British Trotskyist added that it hated Muslims. What do you think of that commentary?
I'm not going to characterize the magazine in general and all of its cartoons, but I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that Charlie came out of the left, and its most consistent target over the past 20 years has been the Front National, the extreme right wing party in France, which is the most racist and xenophobic party in France. So I don't think that in general Charlie should be thought of as racist or xenophobic or anti-Islamic. On the other hand, it did publish quite a series of very strong attacks on Islamic radicalism.
Which is not the same as Islam, which he pointed out.
It's not the same as Islam. One has to say they published cartoons mocking the Prophet Muhammad. That's probably what precipitated the slaughter of the 10 people at its offices. But at the same time, they were attacking the enemies of France's Muslims at home. So I think every viewer of these cartoons has to judge for themselves what they meant. I personally did not consider it an anti-Islamic magazine or a racist magazine, but I did have my differences of opinion with some of what they published. And my own approach to political criticism would not have been theirs.
Now, let's talk some about the status of Muslims in French society. I read a response to charges that Charlie was racist and Islamophobic by a Arab woman who was on the staff of the magazine. And she argued that what people call France's Islam problem is more precisely about integrating descendants of North African from the former colonies. Is that a more precise specification of France's problem?
Yes. France certainly has a problem of integrating its minority elements, and its colonial past plays a significant role there. However, I think you also have to say that France has made great strides in integrating those recent immigrants and descendants of immigrants, some of whom have been there for two and three and four generations now. Muslims are well represented in the French bureaucracy, the administration of the French government, among school teachers, among the army. They're overrepresented in the army. They're overrepresented in the police force, and it's significant that one of the policemen killed trying to defend the offices of Charlie Hebdo was, as you know, a Muslim policeman. These institutions, the government, the bureaucracy, the army, and the police, have been the traditional avenues by which minority groups have made their way into the center of French society. So Muslims are being integrated, but there are also serious pockets of alienated and disaffected young Muslims. We also see evidence of this in the wake of the events, in reports from several schools in some of the tougher Muslim-dominated suburbs that say that school children as young as 10 years old refuse to participate in the national moment of silence of respect for the dead. And when their teachers asked them why they were refusing, they said that it was because the dead cartoonists had shown disrespect for the prophet of their religion. So there is this alienation, whether it stems from France's colonial past or from the judgment of Muslims about France's role in geopolitical contests pitting Western powers against Muslim countries, is something that has to be sorted out. And France is going to be wrestling with this problem for some time to come in trying to figure out how to integrate better this population that exists within its midst. And it should be pointed out that this is the largest Muslim concentration in Europe, in France, but it's still only about 8% of France's population. So it's a smaller group than than African Americans in the United States, for example. And the problems of disaffection are the same as you see in some of the more alienated urban areas in the United States. I think of East Baltimore or South L.A. or parts of Chicago and Philadelphia. And as we've seen in the wake of Ferguson, Missouri, the counties around St. Louis. So there are places in the United States where you find a similar kind of alienation and opposition to the forces that represent authority, just as you do in France.
I'm speaking with Art Goldhammer, who is a fellow at the Center for European Studies at Harvard. And what about the political repercussions of this? I mean, is France going through something like what the U.S. went through in the days after 9/11 of paranoia and security crackdown?
Well, it's too early to say, but I think that is certainly one worry. This massive demonstration that occurred on Sunday, which was the largest in French history, which saw about 4 million people, marching in honor of the dead, was a remarkable demonstration of national unity. But as we know from the aftermath of 9/11 in the United States, national unity can soon turn to more aggressive expressions of majority opinion against what is perceived as foreign elements or foreign opponents to what the country stands for. So the immediate reaction has been, of course, some discussion of how to tighten security, which includes increased surveillance, including increased electronic surveillance, and beefing up the capacity to analyze the material that the intelligence services are already collecting, because we already know that French intelligence services had a great deal of information on the three people involved in these killings, but they hadn't been able to put that information together and determine that they were about to move into violent action. So there's been some discussion of what to do about that. Also discussion of tightening the borders and perhaps preventing French residents who have gone to fight in Syria or Iraq from returning to France. Now, under current law, it's difficult to prevent French citizens from returning, but some of the people who have gone and who have become jihadis are known to have dual citizenship, and in their case, they can be stripped of the French portion of their citizenship and barred from reentry. So that's one of the things that's under consideration.
And is Marine Le Pen likely to be the beneficiary of these events? I mean, is there, what's the likelihood that she'll be the next president of France?
Well, I think because, at least my hope is that because of France's two-round voting system, she will still have a very high hurdle to overcome. I think it's likely that she will pick up some votes as a result of this. The events certainly have dramatized the fact that France does have a problem with alienated minorities living within its midst. And that has been Marine Le Pen's stock in trade for the last several years. So undoubtedly, she will pick up some political support in the immediate aftermath. But we'll see how long that sticks. Still, I think her negatives remain very high, and for that reason, it's unlikely she'll become the next president. That doesn't mean that she won't become the head of a political force with alarming power and greater influence than it has to date. At the moment, the Front National has only two representatives in the French National Assembly, but it could easily pick up more seats. There are two elections this year, municipal and regional elections, and in both of those elections, the Front National is likely to pick up more support on the local and regional level. So it will certainly be one of the beneficiaries of this event. I think the other beneficiary is Nicolas Sarkozy, who's trying to make a comeback. He had already taken control of the party that he had led before becoming president. But he had a serious rival in his bid to become the 2017 presidential candidate of that party, namely Alain Juppé. And I think one consequence of this event is that in order to show national unity, Hollande turned to Sarkozy as the legitimate anointed representative of the opposition. And I think that gave Sarkozy a boost over his rival Juppé in becoming the presidential candidate.
And what's the likelihood that the mainstream parties will begin to import some of the National Front's politics, or have they done so already and this just might intensify it?
Well, they have certainly done so already. That was essentially Sarkozy's campaign in 2012. He had tried to co-opt the National Front by stiffening his opposition to immigration and the like, and he will probably continue along that path. But I think the rhetoric of the Socialist Party is also going to stiffen so that you'll see tougher rhetoric against immigration from all parties, not only the National Front. And the effort in both cases, both the Socialists and the UMP, will be to try to push the National Front back to the margins. There was a controversy over the national demonstration of mourning on Sunday. The events were organized by a representative of the Socialist Party who had issued semi-official invitations to representatives of not only political parties, but also civil society groups in France. And the only party excluded was the National Front. I personally think this was a political mistake because it gave Marine Le Pen an opening to say that she was being excluded, even though she's a legal, the representative of a legal political party. I think it would have been much better just to include her quietly and make it a demonstration of national unity and then take whatever steps were going to be taken to marginalize the party afterwards. But that wasn't the choice that was made, and we'll see what the results were.
And then what about the status of Jews? There's been a lot of anxiety expressed that Jews are targets in France. There's a big story in the New York Times on how many Jews are looking to emigrate to Israel. What's your reading on that?
Well, there is certainly a new anti-Semitism in France. It's important to emphasize that it has little to no continuity with the traditional anti-Semitism in France, which goes back to the late 19th century. Edouard Drumont, a prominent nationalist journalist, and in the time of the Dreyfus Affair and so on. And that continued through the 1930s and the occupation. But as I said, that's been dwindling in recent years. And even the Front National has abandoned its former connection under Jean-Marie Le Pen with that traditional anti-Semitism. The new anti-Semitism stems largely from Muslim quarters. It's not an attitude shared by all Muslims, but it is certainly shared by some. Who believe that believe in many of the traditional tropes of anti-Semitism, that Jews have undue political power, wield political power because of financial influence, are wealthier than other groups in the population, and use their wealth to exert political control. Those such beliefs are exist among Muslims in France. It's very hard to measure the extent to which they exist. But France's authorities have taken a very strong line against this. On the symbolic level, François Hollande, on Sunday during the morning ceremony, visited the Grand Synagogue in Paris and wore a kippah, a yarmulke, as a symbol of solidarity with the Jews. And given France's tradition of what they call laïcité, a strict secularism in the public sphere, this was a very powerful gesture of support for Judaism on the part of French officials. So that, too, is a break with the ugly past of anti-Semitism in France, when French authorities in the Vichy regime cooperated with the Germans in rounding up Jews and deporting them. So whatever anti-Semitism exists in France now has no official support whatsoever. And beyond Hollande's symbolic gesture and a very strong speech in support of the Jews, you also had very strong words from Manuel Valls, the prime minister, who recognizes the dangers of anti-Semitism in France today and says that strong steps will be taken to rooted out wherever it exists and can be found. Now, exactly what's going to be done remains to be seen.
And does this all give France something else to worry about besides declinism?
Yes, and I think it's healthy that it should take its mind off declinism for a while, because France's decline is exaggerated. In economic terms, it maintains its position among the leading economies of the world. It's having some difficulties because of austerity in the euro and the difficulties that have been imposed on all of Europe by Germany's intransigent position on these economic issues. But still, it's been coping, sometimes better and sometimes worse. But its decline is really exaggerated. And I think for a long time, this social problem that has now been highlighted by the dramatic events of the past week have really been the key problem that France needs to deal with, how to integrate better its minority groups. It's a much more important and much more potentially disruptive issue than the economic issue. And in some ways, it is also a reflection of the economic issue, because what's really driving these youths into alienation is despair and hopelessness. And that despair and hopelessness is undoubtedly related to the extremely high levels of unemployment that you see in these suburbs where the ugliest manifestations of anti-Semitic sentiment have been exposed. These are places where youth unemployment runs in the 30s, 40s, and even as high as 50% in some places. Clearly these people have very little to look forward to, and that's one of the things that's driving them into the arms of radical recruiters.
I was Art Goldhammer, a fellow at Harvard's Center for European Studies and prolific translator from the French. He blogs at artgoldhammer.blogspot.com. artgoldhammer.blogspot.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the end of Beethoven's Fidelio, in the hope that bourgeois society might live up to its constantly broken promises, though the realization of that will no doubt require the transcendence of bourgeois society. This is performed by the Bavarian State Orchestra and Chorus under Colin Davis. Till next week, bye.